This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
Five weeks ago, we brought you the story of a young man who was suffering from amnesia and living in a homeless shelter in San Diego. Thanks to you, our viewers, he now knows who he is and will soon be reunited with his family. Tonight, the dramatic conclusion to his story. And we will introduce you to this woman, also suffering from amnesia and needing your help to find out who she is. We will also examine accusations that a nurse in Texas named Ethel Nation sold dozens of babies to adoptive parents. Two of those infants who are now adults would like your help to find their natural parents. And finally, with Halloween almost upon us, two tales of things that go bump in the night. During the Civil War, this building was an important outpost for the Union Army. Today it is a museum, and many employees believe some of the old soldiers never left. This building, an upscale restaurant known as the Moss Beach Distillery, also has a spectacular and intriguing past. Legend has it that during the Roaring Twenties, it was a hotbed for loose women, bathtub gin, racketeering, and mobsters. Over the years, eyewitnesses recount a series of strange happenings right here in the distillery. Eerie sights and sounds that no matter how hard you try, cannot be explained. Some believe that the ghosts of the Roaring Twenties are still here today, brewing up spirited mischief to make a fascinating and chilling unsolved mystery. Moss Beach is a lonely, windswept cove which lies 20 miles south of San Francisco. The Moss Beach Distillery is perched on a bluff overlooking the cove. The restaurant's name pays homage to the building's history. During the heady days of Prohibition, it was a notorious speakeasy. In recent years, all manner of strange goings-on have been reported at the Moss Beach Distillery. Waitresses swear the cold wind swirled through the dining room, but no windows or doors are open. One of the former owners claims she has seen objects fly through the air and doors locked mysteriously of their own accord. At last count, as many as five different ghosts have been reported lurking in and around this restaurant. Now, I've been here all day and I haven't seen a single ghost, but over the years, a lot of other people have, or say they have. And since it's almost Halloween, the rest of us should at least try to keep an open mind. According to local legend, all this ghostly business began some 70 years ago with a beautiful lady in blue. The Roaring Twenties, flappers, fast living, illegal booze.
Hey, Eddie, tell those lumps to get the lead out.
Frank's Roadhouse, the speakeasy at Moss Beach, was a favorite jumping off point for bootleggers.
Gentlemen, the best whiskey money can buy. Fresh off the boat.
Frank's was also the setting for a legendary love triangle.
With my compliments.
The lady was beautiful. She always wore blue. The piano player had eyes only for her, but their romance was conducted in secret because the lady in blue belonged to someone else. The lovers communicated in code, a silent language in which the lift of an eyebrow spoke volumes. The lady's husband was a bootlegger, and that night she made a serious mistake. Unaware that he would soon arrive, she signaled the piano player to meet her on the beach. Moss Beach was a bootlegger's haven, isolated and sheltered under a cliff just outside the speakeasy.
See my wife down here?
When the lady's husband found out she had left Frank's Roadhouse, he made his way to the cove and frantically questioned his cronies.
Son of a... Hey, Mick, keep in the bottle!
Suddenly, the bootlegger saw his wife with a piano player and went mad with jealousy.
Oh, sorry. That's all right. Hey, evening, Max.
Very bad move, Eddie.
No, Eddie. No, relax.
Hey, do that to me.
I'm telling you, relax!
Stop!
Stop!
A knife flashed. A gun was drawn. The lady threw herself between the two men she loved.
Eddie! Oh!
When the struggle was over, the beautiful lady in blue lay lifeless, victim of her lover's dagger, or so it is said. Some will deny that she ever existed, but others will swear that her ghost haunts Moss Beach to this very day. Believers claim that just as the Blue Lady once held court inside the speakeasy, her spirit now pervades the restaurant, breathing a chill wind down the necks of women she sees as rivals. Moreover, some employees swear that she calls out their names seductively when they are all alone in the dining room.
She's mischievous. A lot of pranks will happen, a lot of things will go on, but I don't think that any of it is malicious. I don't think that anything is supposed to be hair raisings and you running out of a building or anything else like that. She's good. She seems to be a kind soul, nice spirit.
It still sort of amazes me that she still is there and still playing tricks on people. You know, every time I come back and talk to someone, they give me the list of all the things that she's been doing.
When Pat and Dave Andrews owned the Moss Beach Distillery, their family lived on the ground floor. They say the Blue Lady seemed to delight in locking them out of their rooms. Pat also says that the Blue Lady liked to play other tricks, especially late at night when Pat was all alone in the restaurant office.
My checkbook lifted right off the shelf above my head and sailed around, just in kind of slowly around in this small room. And I just told her to put it back and it went right back onto the shelf.
I was a total skeptic. Couldn't have been more skeptical than, it would be impossible to be more skeptical than I was. And I just didn't believe in it. And then as time went on, the things that happened, you know, totally brought me around to the point of view that it is here. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It happened.
On the cliff outside the restaurant, some neighborhood children once claimed they saw the Blue Lady, but she seemed to be a very different kind of ghost. Not the playful spirit who dwelt indoors, but one with a somber demeanor, concerned for the children's safety.
Children, please, please listen. Go back. Go away. It's dangerous. Please. Listen. Hurry.
The housekeeper of one of the restaurant employees believes she has met the same spirit and that it is definitely not the two-timing flapper of popular legend.
The first time I see the Blue Lady is one night. I am very sick. I have cold, I have fever. Yeah, I see one person in the side in my bed.
¿Tú eres Consuelo?
Sí, yo soy Consuelo.
Quiero hablar contigo porque tú tienes algo mío.
No sé, no tengo nada tuyo.
Estoy hablando de mi música.
Oh.
The mysterious blue lady would soon reappear, this time just after Consuela had finished showering. She claims that once again, the spirit asked for her music and then revealed her name.
Mi nombre es Alma Reed.
The name Alma Reed conjured a dim memory from Consuela's childhood. When she was 10 years old, Consuela's father had given her sheet music written by one of his close friends, Ricardo Palmarin, a famous Mexican musician. The song was titled Peregrina. It was dedicated to Ricardo's beloved. Her name was Alma Reed. According to Consuela, Alma Reed and Ricardo Palmarin were star-crossed lovers. Alma was already married to another man when she fell in love with a handsome musician. Legend has it that in 1927, she walked into the sea, preferring death to life without her beloved Ricardo. Some say she drowned herself off the Northern California coast, not far from Moss Beach.
I became involved with the Blue Lady.
Sylvia Brown has a national reputation as a psychic. She has worked with the police on many unsolved criminal cases. In 1992, the owner of the Moss Beach Distillery asked her to find out just who the Blue Lady was.
And I said, I have more things to do than to go ghost chasing. But I said, what the heck? So after I got up here, I walked in and said, oh my God, there is a ghost here. And I'm getting the name Mary Ann or Mary Ellen Morley. And she seems to be swathed all in sort of like a hat, blue.
The restaurant employees were surprised when Sylvia came up with a totally new identity for the Blue Lady.
Maybe I'd say 26, maybe 27.
Sylvia went on to say that Mary Ellen Morley had been killed by crushing blows to the chest and head.
But her demeanor seems...
We took that information, went over to the San Mateo County Vital Statistics and researched documentation between 1910 and 1930, and in fact came up with a name that Sylvia Brown had mentioned during dinner, Mary Ellen Morley.
God, Jennifer, look at this.
What'd you get? Oh, you're kidding. Mrs. Fred W. Moore.
Jennifer Towner and Jan Mucklestone, another restaurant employee, dug through the archives and made an eerie discovery. Mary Ellen Morley's maiden name was Reed, and in an astounding coincidence, she had a sister named Alma.
This is all checking out. This is just incredible.
Jennifer and Jan are also intrigued by the newspaper accounts of Mary Ellen Morley's death.
She's also known as Maisie Reed.
When she was killed, it made front page news in the Redwood City Standard as well as the Times Gazette, and so it was really chilling when I came upon that, because all of a sudden she became very real.
Mary Ellen Morley lived in Redwood City, California, near the San Francisco Bay. On the day of her death, Mary Ellen and her husband Frederick had driven north to visit her mother's grave. The cemetery was 15 miles from the Moss Beach Distillery. Returning home on the Bayshore Highway that same night, Frederick lost control of his automobile. It overturned, and Mary Ellen was trapped in the wreckage.
You all right?
The car. It's heavy. Get it off me, please.
With her last breath, she asked Frederick to take care of their three-year-old son, Jack.
Jack, for me.
When Frederick Morley heard a car, he frantically ran for help. But in the end, he could do nothing to save his wife. The injuries she suffered were crushing blows to the chest and head, the exact injuries described by Sylvia Brown.
Help me!
You say that you're very tired.
The owner of the distillery called Sylvia Brown back to the restaurant for a seance.
Because you've been walking so long. So cold, so tired.
Sylvia claimed that Mary Ellen Morley's spirit was weary from searching for Jack, her son. From
Hannah Elder.
Incredibly, Sylvia also says she saw three other spirits with Mary Ellen. A beautiful blonde named Anna Philbrick, her dashing lover, John Contina, and Hannah Elder, a Mennonite woman. As the seance came to an end, Sylvia said Mary Ellen warned there would soon be a fire at the restaurant.
Concerned? Is that what you're saying, Mary Ellen?
4 or 5 days later, after this, we had a fire here in the restaurant. We had to close the restaurant temporarily. And that was really eerie. That was kind of scary.
I've moved from a 1 on a scale of 10 of belief to somewhere in the neighborhood of an 8, I would say, and a 10 with regard to my Blue Lady. I'm convinced she's here.
Does the spirit of a beautiful Blue Lady really haunt the Moss Beach Distillery? If so, who could she be? Most people now believe she is Mary Ellen Morley, the young mother who died in a tragic car accident. Others swear that the Blue Lady is Alma Reed, the ill-fated lover of Ricardo Palmarine. A few still hold with the original legend of the beautiful flapper who romanced a piano player at Frank's Roadhouse. Perhaps all three women haunt Moss Beach. Perhaps the Moss Beach Distillery is not only a watering hole for humans, but a gathering place for spirits as well. When we return, a tale of a haunting from a different era. Some say that spirits from a civil war have taken up residence in the Drum Barracks Museum. On April 12, 1861, the first tragic shots of the American Civil War were fired at Fort Sumter, South Carolina. Over the next 4 years, the battle raged along a 1,000-mile front. Though most of the fighting took place in the southern states, the Union war effort eventually spread across the country, all the way to Wilmington, California. In 1862, a military installation was established on 60 acres overlooking Los Angeles Harbor. Christened the Drum Barracks after an obscure lieutenant colonel, the facility was a key center for training and processing troops. By the end of the war, nearly half of California's 17,000 Union volunteers had passed through the barracks. Today, all that remains of the outpost is a single building which now houses a modest museum and some very unlikely tour guides.
I don't call them ghosts, or I don't call them hauntings usually. What I do believe in is we call them spirits.
It's a comfortable feeling. They don't bother me. And I'm very comfortable here with them.
You can lock the rooms at night, I do. I make a check, in fact, very religiously. I check all the rooms, they're locked, the lights are off, the shades are down. And you come here at 8 o'clock in the morning and the light in the parlor jolly well might be on, and then again it might not, but the shades may be up.
In 1986, Marge O'Brien was hired to revitalize the Drum Barracks. The museum had fallen into disrepair, despite being declared a historic landmark in 1963.
It was very dark, very sad feeling as you walk through. And it was just kind of a building, just kind of standing here saying, help me.
Over the next few months, Marge and a team of craftsmen and volunteers worked diligently to overhaul the museum. The officers' lounge was faithfully restored and new displays were installed. The old building was coming back to life in more ways than one.
I'm sitting in my office doing the proverbial paperwork, and something will take my attention. Either a window will rattle, the roses will hit against the window, the wind possibly, but something attracts me to the fact that I should be checking something. I will walk over to the parlor. 9 chances out of 10, when I have this feeling and I open the door, more likely than not, the lights on the table are on. Most times, I will walk up the stairs and check the gun room. Very often, that too has the lights on and the window blinds open, even though they have been closed and down. Because the rule here is that after every tour, you pull the shades down, turn off the light, and lock the door.
Never thought much about ghosts. I've never inquired about it, never tried to speak to the dead, never got involved. Even when I first came here, I took it very lightly.
Forrest Neal was always a skeptic when it came to ghosts and the like, until the summer of 1989.
It was on a Monday morning, museum being closed. I'm here by myself. And I heard someone walking in one of the hallways. As it continued, I walked out of my door looking down the stairway. I proceeded down, knowing that someone was probably in the gift shop hiding, waiting for me to leave. As I went in the gift shop, no one. When I opened the bathroom, I expected for something to happen. And there was no one in the bathroom. And since then, I've become pretty much a believer.
We were up there in the gun room, cleaning, dusting. My group.
Yasmin works with volunteer groups who assist in the museum's upkeep. In 1991, she too began to believe that the drum barracks might in fact be haunted.
I think we're done for the day. Let's go. I put down the blinds and turned off the light and locked the room and left. Came downstairs and left the building. There was nobody around.
You will be back Friday, won't you?
Yeah, sure. What time?
10:30. The silver needs polishing.
Okay, we'll do that. Okay. When I looked up, I saw the blind and the window that we were working went up really slow. Did you just see that?
What?
The blind went up by itself. It gave me the impression as if someone was holding it, you know, someone was doing it.
To me, a ghost was like Casper the Friendly Ghost or some movie or something, you know. I guess, you know, one doesn't believe it until they actually are really convinced.
Fred Duran is an exterminator for the city of Los Angeles, and the museum is among his regular stops. On one visit in particular, Fred got all the convincing he needed.
As I got into the kitchen that morning, I heard some footsteps behind me, and I thought it was the caretaker.
I need to get some water.
Yeah.
And I didn't pay any attention to it.
Have you seen Maria?
No, I haven't seen her.
As I turned around, there was this guy there. I thought it was kind of odd because he was in a Civil War outfit. And I thought it was the caretaker that lived there. So as I was going out towards, you know, the front of the building to go out towards my vehicle, and then I saw the caretaker there and the workmen also. And I just asked him, I said, you know, hey, the guy that lives here takes his job seriously. And they said, you saw the captain's ghost. And I said, oh, come on, guys. And they said, no, you actually saw the captain's ghost.
If Fred said he saw it, he saw it. I have no doubts in that. Fred's a very honest man. My reaction is, I wonder why, at this point, what the reason was at this point in time, why he had to come now, and why to Fred.
This was the hallway I was talking about,
Marge. Marge O'Brien became determined to find out who or what had taken up residence in the drum barracks. In 1991, she asked Barbara Connor, an internationally recognized psychic, to visit the museum.
Very different. Oh, this is the parlor.
She says, we seem to have some creaks and groans, and I thought, right away, mentally, I thought to myself, oh, it's an old house, it's just settling. And I said, well, I've never done it before, but sure, I'd like to come out. So we came out and started to go through the barracks.
Here.
Often when I come in, the light is on.
According to Barbara Connor, the drum barracks was teeming with ghostly activity. In the officer's lounge, she claims to have encountered several spirits. Two were playing cards. Another stood by the window, peering through the curtains. But one phantom seemed more forceful than the rest.
He looked at me, and he says, I want this chair closer to the fireplace because I'm cold. And I was telling Marge, I said, this gentleman that's sitting in this chair here has a foot that is, his boot is too tight for him.
What was interesting is my research showed that Colonel Curtis, who was the commander here the longest, had frostbitten his left foot when he was fighting Indians up in Washington. Right around the ankle, above where the nerve endings were, was a great deal of pain, which he suffered much of his life. He would wear a boot that was a size smaller so that he could have more control of that foot, and he dragged it. There is no way Barbara could have known that when she walked into the room. I had just started to uncover this research.
Upstairs, Barbara Connor continued to have visions, which seemed to explain some of the strange noises Marge and the staff had grown familiar with.
There's a little boy sitting here. He's bouncing a ball back and forth.
I told Marge, I said, there's a little boy here, and he's throwing the ball up against the wall. And she goes, that's what that is. And I go, what? She says, well, we've heard this thump, 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 and we couldn't figure out what it is. And I said, well, that's it. He's throwing this ball up against the wall. And I said, if you want him to stop, just tell him to stop, and he'll stop.
Now I'd like to take you into the storage room. I don't often.
As the tour came to an end, Barbara Connor says she saw the specters of Colonel Curtis and his officers in a planning session.
The colonel was standing there at the table, and when we came in, he looked at us, then all of a sudden he started looking in a box over on the side, like he left what he was doing and went over and started digging in this box, and he turned to me and mentally projected, he wants his award. He wants the award. He's trying to find an award. And I said, what award? And he says, I have an award. I want my award, and I want it on that wall.
Well, I had never heard of a plaque before, and I don't remember anything ever hanging in that storage room. But I discovered later that when he left Washington, that Colonel Curtis did receive an award for his work with the Indians up there. And possibly that could have been the plaque.
Commander Curtis, gentlemen, it's time to go home. Lights out. If you want them back on, that's fine with me.
I believe that there's something here. People ask me, have I seen it? I haven't seen it, and apparently they don't talk to me. And if I'm wrong in talking to spirits, well, then I'm wrong, because I do. I've become accustomed to them.
I'm pleased that they're here, if indeed they are, because it means someone with a longer span here is going to take care of this place, and it will be taken care of.
Do the long dead spirits of the Civil War still roam the drum barracks? At this point, the museum staff has little doubt. Skeptics might say they have overactive imaginations or perhaps a fanatic reverence for the past. But those who've experienced the unguided tour of the museum believe it is nothing less than a case of living history. When we return, a young man and woman sold as infants by a nurse in Texas are searching for their natural mothers. These three infants were all born in San Antonio, Texas between 1959 and 1966. What they have in common is a connection to an opportunistic woman, a woman who, according to some, ran a secret but profitable business in which she sold babies for more than 20 years. That questionable enterprise first came to light when the mother of this infant began looking for her.
Good grief, I don't know how you were.
In November of 1959, 18-year-old Dileen Zolikoff was alone, scared, and 7 months pregnant. She was taken in by a nurse in San Antonio named Ethel Nation. On January 6, 1960, Dileen gave birth to a healthy baby girl. Almost immediately, Ethel whisked the infant away.
Ethel stole my baby. And I searched. I tried everything in San Antonio. I talked to a lawyer. Ethel wouldn't help me. I just couldn't find my baby.
Ethel Nation always denied that she had anything to do with the disappearance of Dileen's baby. But in 1968, Dileen found a photograph of her daughter in Ethel's house. It took another 15 years of searching before Dileen and her daughter were reunited on national television.
When I first saw my daughter, she looked beautiful. And she smiled. And I was just overjoyed. It was so beautiful to finally, after all these years, I finally found her.
While the story of Dileen Zolikoff and her daughter has a happy ending, the stories of two other young people who were sold by Ethel Nation are far from over. Perhaps someone in our audience tonight can help unlock the secrets of their past. Scott Merz was born in San Antonio in 1965. His adoptive parents were unable to have children and paid Ethel Nation $1,200 for Scott. Scott grew up knowing he had been adopted. When he was 10, he began to have an odd recurring dream which seemed to be about the mother he never knew and perhaps the place where he was born.
I remember walking through the main doorway. I remember feeling very cold in this place. I felt like very, very horrible things went on there. There was a table, and beside this table, there was a man in a green robe and a lady dressed in white. I don't know what they were doing there. When I woke up almost screaming. I mean, I was really, really scared.
He said, I was born in that room. I was born in that room. And he said, I feel like my birth mother was having a rough time in her life. And for some reason, I felt very drawn to her, almost like she was calling me.
When Scott was 18, he and his adoptive mother, Mary, began an intensive search for his natural mother. Scott's adoption records reveal few clues, so he and Mary paid a visit to Ethel Nation.
She seemed really nice. She seemed like she wanted to help. Then, as the times grew on, it got worse and worse and worse.
Ms. Nation, I just need to ask you a few more questions.
Scott and Mary visited Ethel on 6 occasions.
Come on in.
With each visit, Ethel changed her story.
Go sit down.
At various times, she told Scott he had been born in 3 different hospitals.
Well?
But none of them had his birth records on file.
Santa Rosa? They have no record of my being born there.
Who said anything about Santa Rosa?
You did.
You must be mistaken. I never mentioned Santa Rosa.
You most certainly did. The last time we came, you told Scotty he had been born at Santa Rosa. I sat right here when you said it.
On the final visit, Ethel became angry and revealed what she said was the bitter truth about Scott's mother.
Santa Rosa, your mother didn't want you. Your mother had an abortion. Your mother was a slut. Your mother was a whore. And you want to know why she didn't have the abortion? Because it was too late.
She told me that I was a bastard child,
that
all my mother was a slut, a whore, and that I should have no right to even look for her. So for me to go home and for me to stop looking for her.
Scott and Mary refused to give up. They decided to visit yet another place where Ethel said Scott had been born, a community health center that in 1965 was known as the Woodlawn Clinic.
This is my son, Scotty.
The very minute that we walked in, I was completely stunned. I couldn't even talk.
This is it.
The feelings that I got from this were just incredible. I mean, it was very of a morbid type feeling, but yet I felt like I had been there before. And everything that in this dream that I had back when I was 10, it was coming true before my eyes.
I was scared to death. He held on to me. I held on to him. We both cried all the way down the hall.
I was so happy that it made sense of the dream that I had many years ago.
Sadly, Scott Mirza still not found his natural mother. But through his search, he met a young woman who had a remarkably similar experience with Ethel Nation. Donette Barker was adopted in July of 1966 by a childless couple from San Antonio. As a last desperate resort, they had approached Ethel Nation after years of trying to adopt through state agencies. Donette learned that on the night she was adopted, her parents had to choose between her and two other infants.
We have these two little boys here that are twins. And this little girl over here. Now, of course, you have your choice, but I would prefer that the boys be kept together if that's at all possible.
There were bassinets in there with children. I think there were two twin boys and myself. My parents didn't, because they didn't expect that things would happen so quickly, they just thought they were going to go to see the baby, but at that point, Mrs. Nations told my parents that they could go ahead and take me home that night.
We can?
Yes, absolutely.
Honey,
is there a problem?
Well, ma'am, we don't have the full 1,700.
I thought that had been settled.
Well, ma'am, we just didn't think we'd be able to take her tonight.
Do you have some kind of property? Do you have anything that you can sell?
How about the boat?
What kind of boat? It's all right. We'll work something out.
As payment for Donette, Ethel Nation accepted a 14-foot ski boat worth $1,700.
You can go ahead and take your baby home.
When she turned 18, Donette began to search for her natural parents. She found that her mother's name was listed as Gloria Cantu. The adoption papers had been notarized by Ethel Nation.
What can I do for you this time?
Donette spoke with Ethel Nation several times and was finally told the same story as Scott Mirza.
Your mother was a tramp. She didn't want you. She went there to have an abortion, but it was just too late to have one.
I don't understand what's happening.
I told you, you shouldn't have been messing around with something like this. You should have left well enough alone.
I really couldn't understand why. Or how she could say that. It hurt.
There is no way of knowing how many babies were sold by Ethel Nation, who died in 1991. Scott Mirza and Donette Barker now suspect that there may be dozens of other young people who, like them, will not be able to rest until they are reunited with their natural mothers. Scott Mirza was born on August 5th, 1965, in San Antonio, Texas. His mother's name was listed as Joyce Collier. She may have been 22 years old. Scott's adopted mother, Mary, met her once and recalls that she was thin with dark hair and an olive complexion.
Is Ethel Nation here?
It's important for me to find her because there's a certain gap, a certain hole that's inside me that I want to fill. And I think the only way that I can fill this hole is to be whole myself. And finding my birth mother will do that.
If she's out there and she is watching, you know, I just want her to know that I don't want anything from her, and I don't want to hurt her, or you know, maybe it's something she's never told anyone, or who she's currently married to if she's married, but I don't want anything, no strings attached. I just want to know what happened and how it happened. I would never in any way want to hurt her.
Donette Barker's birthday is listed as July 21st, 1966, but she may have been born weeks earlier. Her mother, Gloria Cantu, may have been 23 years old when Donette was born. Both Scott Murs and Donette Barker Lucier may have been born in the Woodlawn Clinic in San Antonio, Texas. On the night of our broadcast, several viewers called our telecenter on behalf of Donette's birth mother, Gloria Cantu Martinez of San Antonio, Texas. A short time later, Donette spoke to her mother for the very first time and learned that Gloria had never intended to give her up, but had been tricked into signing the adoption papers. Donette was overjoyed to discover that Gloria wanted to see her as soon as possible. On November 9, 1992, Gloria flew to Washington, D.C. for a tearful reunion with Donette. For mother and daughter, it was an emotional end to 26 years of painful separation.
When I was waiting for her to come out from the plane, a million things were going through my mind. Just relief that it was over, that I was finally where I wanted to be after a long time of looking.
I just couldn't believe it, that it was finally gonna happen. What I always wanted. I've always wanted to find her and wondered what she was like, if she was married, if she had any children.
The reunion was made even more special when Gloria met her four grandchildren for the first time. Donette's dream of having her entire family together had finally come true.
This is Michael.
How are you?
This is Tyler.
Tyler.
Hi, Gloria.
Next, a woman stricken with amnesia needs your help in tonight's Special Alert. Last month, we aired the story of a young man in San Diego, California, who had no idea who he was or where he had come from. In May of 1992, he had wandered into a local homeless shelter, apparently suffering from complete and total amnesia. Doctors were baffled by his memory loss. The only clue to his identity was a Boston Library card which bore the name Pierre April. Update. On the night of our broadcast, a viewer in Canada called our telecenter to say that the young man had once worked for his wife and that his name is, in fact, Pierre April. Pierre soon learned that he has two sisters and that his parents live in Lachine, Canada, where his father practices medicine. The next day, they spoke on the phone for the first time in more than 5 months.
It was a very emotional moment. And then I even had to tell him that I couldn't even trust him 100%, that I wanted the package with family pictures in it and with my birth certificate in it and anything else he could think of. And he said, okay, we'll send that to you. And then he said, do you remember your mom? And I said, no. And she was listening on the extension and she burst into tears.
A few days later, the packet arrived. Pierre sat down with his fiancée, whom he met in San Diego, and a friend, to get reacquainted with his past.
It is strange to be told who you are and what you did. I'm someone again. And for quite a few months, I was nobody and nothing.
Shortly after Pierre's story aired, we were contacted by authorities in Richardson, Texas, a suburb of Dallas, about another unusual case of amnesia involving a woman who calls herself Sandra Evans.
Like, there's a wall across my brain, and it won't let me see the other side. Occasionally, a snapshot comes through, and I get a glimpse of a life before, but nothing solid, nothing concrete.
On May 14, 1992, Sandra fainted in a Dallas area bus station and was transported to a local hospital. She seemed to be suffering from total amnesia, and the police were notified.
I did receive numerous phone calls from around the United States, from law enforcement agencies and citizens in general, thinking that they may know who Sandra actually is. We did follow up on all of the phone calls we received, and we're not able to determine who she actually is.
This photograph was taken the day Sandra was found. Initially, she could not remember her name, and she is still not sure that she truly is Sandra Evans. This is what I was wearing. In fact, the tag on the luggage she was carrying had the name Linda Kennedy on it. Sandra says the handwriting is hers, but is certain the name is not. The strongest clues to Sandra's identity are several photographs found in the luggage. There is one of Sandra as a bride. Another shows two young children. And finally, a picture of a teenage girl, which appears to be a high school graduation portrait.
They troubled me. I didn't want to deal with the thought if they could be my children. It was much easier to believe they could be nieces and nephews, because the thought of them being mine and not knowing where they are, not knowing who they are, not knowing what conditions were that they were in, was too upsetting.
At this point, Sandra believes her amnesia is a result of some traumatic, perhaps violent experience, and she is haunted by a vague fear of both her past and her future.
I am afraid of what I'm going to find on the other side, because something made me forget it. I am afraid that if I've had children, that they won't understand where I've been for the last 5 months. That if my mother must be elderly, if this is doing something to her.
Update. Just moments after this story aired in Canada, a viewer contacted authorities there and identified Sandra Evans as her sister Carol Ann Rozak of London, Ontario. Carol Ann soon learned that she is divorced and that the photographs found in her luggage were of her two sons, now teenagers, and her 13-year-old daughter.
When I talked to my daughter, I asked her about things that we had done, and she said we did everything together. She said we were real close. In fact, the first time I talked to her, it was more like she was the mother and I was the daughter. She was so sweet. She was so excited to talk to me.
Even though the information about her past did nothing to jog her memory, Carol Ann immediately began packing to return to Canada, where her children, her four sisters and her brother would be waiting. On October 30th, 1992, a nervous Carol Ann, accompanied by friends she had made in Texas, arrived at the Dallas airport to board a flight that would take her back to her family 6 months after she disappeared.
Oh yes, I'm happy to go home. A little nervous, but I'm happy to be going home.
Today, Carol Ann lives with her daughter in Milton, Ontario. She still has no idea what caused her amnesia, but is currently undergoing therapy in the hope that someday she will fully recover her memory. Join me next time. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery.